WFYI podcast brought to you by Bloomington, Indiana, an American college town offering food and drink, college sports, outdoor activities, live music, cool art, and good times daily. Everyone is welcome in Bloomington. More information at visitbloomington.com.
We're going to take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break
it down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with David Andrichik, owner of the legendary Indianapolis jazz club, The Chatterbox. David is celebrating his 40th year as the owner of The Chatterbox. When he purchased the club in 1982, the Chatterbox was a local watering hole for the neighborhood's factory workers. But in just a few years, David transformed the Chatterbox into one of the most loved jazz clubs in Indiana. Jazz stars like Wynton Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard have performed on the Chatterbox stage, and the club has hosted VIP guests like the Rolling Stones. An impressive resume for a venue that occupies less than 1,000 square feet of space. But the Chatterbox is best known for providing a stage for multiple generations of Hoosier jazz musicians, from Jimmy Coe to Rob Dixon. For the next hour, David Andrichik will share an oral history of the Chatterbox, and we'll listen to music from some of the Indianapolis artists who've been featured at the club. Let's join my conversation with David Andrichik. Am I correct? This is the 40th anniversary of the Chatterbox.
Correct. 2022. Correct. I purchased Chatterbox in that name in May of 82. So this is our 40th year this spring, and then we're going to do a little modest celebration in a couple weeks.
Great. And before we get into your history with this club, I wanted to get a little info about your background. From
sure.
What I understand, you grew up in Chicago. Is that correct?
Yes, Chicago Public Schools in Cook County, Bogan High School. And then my parents and the family moved to the western suburbs for my senior year, which was Lombard. And then I graduated at that time and then went down immediately to University of Illinois in Champaign. So I was following an architectural degree down there and completed it. It's a 5-year program, and it took me 5.5 to finish, and then became, you know, interested in being a professional architect, was married at the end of my college career. And my wife, Diane, got a job in Indianapolis with American Can Company as an executive in the office, a junior executive, of course. And this was in the 1970s. So they were, in fact, promoting women early to be more on the professional side rather than secretarial and so on. But that's what got me here to Indianapolis. I got a job a couple weeks later as an architectural intern and then started to work that way. So we were together a couple more years, friendly divorce, and I stayed here, and she moved to the Chicago area and then eventually to Texas.
And what year did you officially move to Indianapolis?
It was in 1974.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was 74, and I was riveted to the television because that's when the Watergate hearings were on.
CBS News, 10 hours from now, Gerald R. Ford becomes the 38th president of the United States. The president announced his resignation Thursday night before what is thought to have been the largest broadcast audience in American history. The threat of impeachment and conviction in the aftermath of Watergate forced him to leave office. Mr. Nixon said he did so because it was necessary for the national interest. The president ended the story.
No, it's not.
Were you living downtown at the time? What part of the city were you?
First moved to the western suburbs, actually by Ben Davis High School. That's where apartments were. And my first job was up near Lafayette. So I was commuting on 65 or 52 north. And Diane worked downtown. So it was that. And then after we split, I bought a house near Butler University off of Westfield Boulevard and 52nd Street. And then I was working for a large architectural firm at that time, James Associates, and they were on East 45th Street, Fall Creek and Binford, essentially.
You know, I've read some interviews with you where you talk about being a casual jazz fan or a jazz aficionado, listening to a jazz radio during your college years. Were you tuned into the jazz scene at all here in Indianapolis prior to taking ownership of the Chatterbox?
None whatsoever, nothing whatsoever. And it was sort of a beautiful serendipitous moment to find out, number one, the history of Indiana Avenue and the musicians, the guys and gals that were part of that heritage, both excellent music education at Crispus Attucks High School and at Shortridge, and then many others, Ben Davis as well. I had no idea when I did this. And when I bought Chatterbox in 82, it was an investment. I wanted to buy a building. Oh, well, the bar came with it. The liquor license came with it. And it was a third shift, first shift bar, like all the bars up and down Mass Avenue or many, you know, in any city in the world near manufacturing places. Because there were lots of little factories up and down College Avenue in downtown Indy. The glove company where they made gloves and Real Silk Hosiery where they made ladies' stockings and parachutes during World War II. So there were lots of little factories. The people that lived around there could walk to those jobs. And it was a one, two, and three shift kind of businesses. So after work third shift at 7:30 or 8 in the morning, their days and nights were turned around. That's when they would want to have the recreation, have a beer afterwards, have conversation, meet their friends, that kind of thing. So that was my discovery when I got finished with my job working for someone else in the architecture business. All of a sudden, I'd go down to see my investment and see what was going on, and we would be closing, and it wasn't much fun. So my thoughts were to add music, and with jazz and blues being my favorite kind from the listening I had done in college, and then even growing up, there were big band stuff that my parents had records of, and the early television always featured jazz groups, especially The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson, all the time. And it was fabulous to see that and learn from that, because I was always a late-night kid and a late-night adult still to this day. And that's what was on. My mom would stay up, help me with my homework. And then we would also be, you know, have the in the background, the music on, that kind of thing. And then I took that to college and, you know, listened late at night.
You are in for a treat. The great Benny Goodman is here tonight. Those of us who grew up in the big band days. This coming Saturday night, he'll be performing at Marin College in Northern California. And he's got a new book out called Benny. It simply bears the title, The King of Swing. Would you welcome Mr. Benny Goodman and friend?
I've read that when you initially bought the building, you had kind of envisioned maybe having an office in the upstairs part of the building, and then maybe having a restaurant or some sort of or keeping it as a bar downstairs. Is that accurate? Is that how you kind of
saw
things going?
I mean, I had different ideas about what was going on, but I had initially a couple of partners that pulled out before I bought it, and I was so deep into it, both financially and psychologically. I borrowed some more time. I invested more money, saved more to add to my earnest money down payment. And when it came to the time of transfer of the liquor license, the previous owner, his name was Bill Popa, he there were fines against the license because one or two of his customers were bookmakers, and they were calling from the wall phone to place bets and to take bets and so on. And oh, my gosh. So the transfer of liquor license eventually was about a year's length of time. First I delayed, and then he delayed, and then it was okay then money-wise afterwards. So I was able to do it on my own but had no money to do any renovation, restoration, as you can see today.
So when you initially purchased this property in 1982, you never envisioned being a full-time bar owner. You wanted to continue your career as an architect, and this was just sort of a side business?
Yeah, that's accurate. It was an investment in downtown property. I got some excellent advice from an unknown at the time person who told me that properties around me on Mass Avenue were being purchased, the apartment properties, residential properties, for utilization of historic tax credits that were done in the bicentennial year, 74 through 76, giving additional tax breaks to those that would do the correct historic redevelopment. And that was where these groups were taking taking advantage of that. And additionally, a friend that was working in the large architectural firm that I was working in, James Associates, her name was Mary King. She was an intern at Ball State in architectural history, and one of her summer projects was to begin to help document properties along Mass Avenue for it to become a district in the National Register, all of Mass Avenue, from the 300 all the way to where the Coca-Cola plant was and now Bottle Works is now. So she was working with various property owners, put me in touch with this gentleman, Scott Keller, still around today. And he returned my phone call and lectured me for maybe half an hour saying that this is what's happening. If you want to buy that building now, you should do it because you will be surrounded by others that are doing it. So it will be a neighborhood, urban neighborhood that will be up and coming, and you'll do well. And it's all true.
And I did want to ask you about the evolution of the neighborhood your business is located in. You know, you mentioned that the prior owner of the bar, one of his patrons was running a gambling operation.
Yes,
the bar.
Yes, right.
And this reflects sort of the tone of the neighborhood. You know,
sure.
Around the time you moved to Indianapolis in the 1970s, early 70s, this neighborhood was referred to as the little hellhole. There was a series of articles in the Star.
Oh, really?
You know, very salacious articles documenting all the activities that went on there, and it was constantly referred to in headlines as the little hellhole. And there were police raids on these buildings, and, you know, there was go-go bars, strip clubs.
Sure.
It was a hangout for all sorts of nefarious
yes.
types, right?
Denizens of the dark.
Yeah. Tell me about this neighborhood in the first years you came to Indianapolis and what it was like when you moved in.
Yeah. Well, I started shopping. I had always had this idea. I wanted to buy a commercial building. And I would put my bicycle in the back of my car and drive to an area that I thought I liked. I liked the buildings. And then I would ride my bicycle around and take pictures to kind of get myself familiar with it, seeing. At that time, I was living right by Butler University. But those are the kinds of things that didn't bother me or I was unaware of or blissfully unaware of, let's say. But when I got down there, I started looking in that neighborhood, let's say, in 80, 81, and then made the final purchase in spring of 82. I saw the anchor of Sears department store where Needler's is now, and after before Needler's was O'Malley's. I saw the anchor of Stout Shoes. I think it's the fifth or sixth generation since 1886. Same family, same shoe store, that kind of thing. One of the buildings that was adjacent to Sears was Economy Plumbing, and Economy is now over on Illinois Street, I believe, between Illinois and Capitol, and they were anchors because that's where people shopped. I mean, you did your plumbing repairs, you bought your pipes, you bought your fittings, you bought all of that. Plus, you could get your groceries right next door after O'Malley's moved in, which was, I think, 86. And then before that, Sears. I remember being involved with a neighborhood association at the time when we heard that Sears was pulling out. It was just shocking because they were like the critical anchor to draw people in. And thankfully, the O'Malley's family came in and just totally rescued the neighborhood by putting an anchor of a grocery store, which we did not have. And it worked out very well over time. And it was certainly a blessing that they saw to it to be able to do that when they didn't really make much money to begin with. And at the end, it was great. It was super.
In, I think, 1982, the Star ran really the first big piece on you and the Chatterbox, and the headline was out with the winos, in with the chic, right?
Yeah.
And in that article, I think you say that in 5 years, I could see this neighborhood becoming sort of like Broad Ripple, right?
That's probably right. I think the author, I don't know if that was the Star of the News, but maybe Ernie Wilkinson was the writer. And likely that article in the state's largest newspaper eventually got me fired from my architectural business.
Wow.
Because there was an internal change of leadership, even though I asked the five partners at James Associates, could I make this kind of investment? And they all gave me the thumbs up approval. It was in historic district, so the historic partner said, oh, absolutely, go ahead and do this, and all the others said yes. But there was a change of majority ownership was the way it was put. And then eventually, because I was getting publicity and not an owner, not of this, just a lowly project architect, I was kind of put on the spot, like, you can't own a bar, da-da-da-da-da. Well, anyway, eventually it was that article that started the ball rolling.
They thought it reflected poorly on the architectural firm or something?
Yeah. And that it was unbecoming of one of their newer people to be a bar owner and get this kind of publicity when it wasn't publicity about architecture.
Sure. So I wanted to ask kind of what was the what sparked the transition from your career as an architect to taking over the bar full time? Was that it? Just out of necessity?
Out of necessity, yes. But then because the liability laws were so much different in the 70s and then early 80s, virtually all the project architects had an outside practice, not because they were looking for work, but the firm never turned down work. If someone wanted a garage or an addition to their home or this, they gave it to you. Here, take this job. They never turned anything down. And it was us that had the stamp and gave the approval and did all the work, but we did it on our own time. So I had enough work to be able to do that, and that's when I put my office over the Chatterbox. So that was, after the transition away from the architecture business with the large firm.
One last question about the early years of the club. I'm curious about the original owner, William Popa, Bill Popa. He had owned the club 40 years, right? He opened it in 41, right?
Yeah, he bought it as the Chatterbox.
Okay.
It was named Chatterbox this is stories he told me. I didn't do research. 39, it was named Chatterbox. He bought it in 41. And the story he told me from the previous owner is that there were boyhood friends that grew up then on different political parties, and they would sit in the front window and argue politics back and forth. And people would come by, I call this place the Chatterbox because these guys are just chattering in the window all the time. I don't know if that's really true, but that was the story told to me by Bill Popa.
What kind of guy was Bill Popa?
He was second generation. His parents were Romanian and born there. He had a big brush mustache, a heavy guy, didn't really drink. He would occasionally have like a Seagram 7 and a little glass of Coke. And that was kind of what I knew. So we were still pretty good acquaintances along the way. And after the purchase was made, he was still a customer at the bar, probably 5 or 6 years. And then his health deteriorated, and then he passed away. But it was essentially that's what I bought, the customer base that were his friends, his acquaintances, and him. And that was the fascinating part. We were the mailbox for many people. They would get their Social Security checks or pension checks, and we would hold them and cash them and then take out what they were doing out of their money. I don't know how many envelopes I had with names of people there. And it was a trust that was earned by Bill Popa, and I continued that trust along the way. And it was great. I mean, that was, you got to know these people that were different than me, different than my family. But, unique, and they had their stories to tell, and it was really worth it.
That's incredible. I never knew that. That's incredible. So, you know, today the Chatterbox is synonymous with jazz music. And I think within the first year, you know, you have the wheels turning to make that transition into a jazz club. How did you kind of take the original crew from this bar along that journey? What was the kind of
I think I mentioned a bit ago that when I'd get down to work after my professional job, we would be closing and it wouldn't be any fun. So I figured I got to have a way to extend the hours later into the evening in order for it to be fun for me and my friends and my contemporaries to do that. And I was always thinking music and jazz or blues. And I'm trying to remember, there was a club downtown in the late 70s. It was over a baseball bar, which was on South Meridian, and it was called like Jazz Aloft, I think. And I believe the two owners were Edie Fitzhugh, who just died about a year ago or so, and Mary Mike Adams. They were collaborators. I don't know if they were owners or how they did it. And it was like you climb up three flights of stairs to be up there, and there was somebody jazz playing, and you would sit on like platforms and seats and stuff like that. It was just like a real happening, as they would say then, and in back into the 60s. It was really, really cool. So I made the acquaintance of Mary Mike. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about doing something, adding music and so on. Can you do something? She says, well, I play blues guitar. I can do this. And so we arranged a couple of nights to do it. And Mary Mike was both an excellent vocalist and a great guitar player and playing blues. But it was always really sad blues, like many blues. There was no upbeat component to it. And I asked her sort of cordially, Mary Mike, can you adjust your repertoire and do something a little more, upbeat in the way of the blues side? She says, I guess you're firing me, huh? And I said, well, no, that was not my motivation. She says, I have a boyfriend who could do something. He's a saxophone player, and maybe we can do that. And that was Mark Radway. And so we started with Mark Radway beginning to play. And then through the months that came up, I was adding, one night, two nights, three nights of music, but discovered there was just an incredible wealth of musicians in the city, both the heritage of Indiana Avenue and those kids that grew up there and had that nurturing and mentorship and so on. And then also the universities that had incredible jazz programs that I was totally unaware of. Indiana University, Butler University, early on, really great. And then eventually, over the next couple of years, Dr. David Baker took over the jazz program down at Indiana University. And then Butler was still very active, both on the classical side and the jazz side. And then since then, three other universities, all within 90 minutes of us. Ball State, tremendous new reputation over the past 20 years. And then UIndy on the south side. And then Marion University, too. So all of them have great jazz programs, great jazz teachers, associates, adjuncts, professors, so on, and then students. So that was the wealth of jazz that I didn't know about that we began to do. And within the first 2 years elapsed time, I ended up with six nights of live music. On Fridays and Saturdays, we would often have two groups, one that started at 9 and went to midnight, another one 12:30 to 3. And it was, fascinating and fun and, late night and crazy. And it was really, really good. Not until this century were bars allowed to be open on Sundays. So, and of course, this century is 22 years old. But so then I opened the seventh day and had the music as well. So.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is David Andrichik, owner of the legendary
Indianapolis Jazz Club, The Chatterbox. David is celebrating his 40th year as the owner of The Chatterbox. Before The Chatterbox became known as one of the premier jazz venues in Indianapolis, group sing-alongs were a big part of the club's event calendar. And that tradition continues today with the annual Chatterbox Christmas and St. Patrick's Day sing-along. Let's return to my conversation with David Andrzejczyk as he shares the origins of this unique Chatterbox tradition.
I found sing-along books in Ayers department store. In the basement of Ayers was a sheet music shop. You could buy songbooks, sheet music, and whatever. Now, this is in the middle 80s. It was still there and still existed. There was a package of 25 sing-along books and then one music book with all the music in it. It was called Life of the Party. And we would sing those. Early days, we would do every Friday a sing-along, which was just, it was fabulous for me, fabulous for Judy, and the customers just really loved it. It was like a happy hour kind of thing where we'd have drink specials and happy hour sing-along. And it was, those were the kind of songs, not only Christmas or St. Patrick's Day, Bicycle Built for Two, Goodnight Irene, you know, those kinds of tunes that were old tunes, 1890s, right. Early 1900s, but many people knew those lyrics because that's kind of what they heard growing up. So it was fabulous. And it was also for my regular customers who knew that. They were of that age, you know, 20 and 30 years older than me at that time. And then they would be familiar with those and they would sing along too, which was really great.
And the sing-alongs continue to this day? You still do the Christmas Day?
Yes, we still event? Do St. Patrick's Day and Christmas. And then we had normally, since I grew up in Chicago, my family lived there. So in the holidays around Christmas, I would go home to visit. And then we had one great friend, Jane Pozek, who said, can we do When the Boss is Away sing-along when you're not here? Because you're never here on Christmas Eve. And I'll just do it. You don't have to pay me. Just tips. And, you know, I get a bottle of wine. I said, perfect. That's great. And she did that until she died, a couple years ago now. Became very ill with cancer. One of the great things, we had another musician, Jan Aldridge, who's a classical harp player but knows all those songs on the piano. She said, I will do that. And so the first year Jan did it, Jane was well enough to come in. Friends brought in so she could both be honored, celebrated, and be part of the handoff of tradition of Christmas Eve sing-along, which was really, it was beautiful.
You featured some of the great legends of Indiana Avenue and some of the great then-contemporary stars of Indianapolis jazz, Pookie Johnson, Jimmy Coe,
right.
And then the younger generation.
Ferez Whitted,
yeah. Steve Ali, Monica Hertzey. Tell me about some of the musicians who came into play. Who really stands out in your mind? There's some specific people I do want to ask you about, but just some of your favorites.
Well, initially it was Claude Sifferlin, and then he mentored Steve Ali. And then on stage, Claude mentored Frank Glover. So that sort of triumvirate of incredible core musicians that, of course, Claude was a mature musician at the time. Steve's my age, so he was maybe 10 years younger. And then Frank, 10 years younger than that kind of thing. Ferez is in the middle of that.
Part of the Hampton family.
Correct. Yeah, We had the Hampton family play on a regular basis of Virtue and Elytra and Carmelita while she was still living. And then, of course, Ferez was the son of that. His dad, Thomas Witt, was a drummer, but I'd never met him. I don't know if he was living at the time or I'm not sure, but that was part of that whole heritage. I remember the Hampton sisters, this was in the late 80s, they would come and play, and they asked when they walked in, they had been there as customers, well, where's our dressing room? And it's like, what do you mean? Because they had in garment bags their gowns that they were going to wear because they were entertainers. That's they said, we are not musicians, we are entertainers. And so we let them change in the back room, which was really nothing. But somebody was out guarding the back room storage door so they could change into their gowns, and the three of them, Virtue, Elytra, Carmelita was the saxophone, bass and keyboard, and I'm trying to remember which of the, Virtue I think was the bass player, nonetheless, they had great, and then, I'm trying to remember the drummer they had, I'll think of it in a minute.
Wasn't Larry Clark?
Yes. Sir Larry Clark.
Yes.
So that was who they had to do their ensemble. And Carmelita, saxophone player, would often play baritone sax, which was about as tall as she was. And so she regularly kind of hung over the front of the stage so she could move with the music and the baritone sax, which was so long. It was really fun and fabulous.
Summertime. And the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high.
Tell me about Pookie Johnson's relationship with the club and Jimmy Coe, some of these, like, you know, iconic names.
Yeah, Pookie was great. He was many of the musicians, let's say that. I think he was part of Wes Montgomery's band
as a saxophone player.
And when Wes sort of hit it big to go out to the West Coast or even travel on touring, Pookie chose to stay home to raise his family. He was a mail carrier, a letter carrier, from what I remember. And he nurtured and mentored many of the other musicians there who even on the he was also I think it was a Boy Scout leader too, so he did all of these mentorings to get the kids to adulthood and to have a proper influence and a musical influence and a real stable influence. He had a home, he had a family, you know, and you know you could count on him. Jimmy Coe was on a regular basis touring a lot. He was a bigger name because he made that choice to do that. I think one of his sons, Earl, is still around in the city, drummer. And he would bring in lots and lots of people. Melvin Rhine on keyboard and Hammond B3 flipping a switch kind of thing. It was fabulous stuff and real heady. But this was a place to play because they didn't have any place to play anymore. Because all those clubs had evolved and gone out of business. And I remember Pookie telling me they learned, because musicians have to be adaptable and they have to pivot, learned how to play rock and roll and dance music and disco music and so on because they had those gigs. They could do those gigs. But the jazz gigs were few and far between. And we provided that venue a little bit of money, but a place to play and a place to teach and collaborate and jam. That was the best part.
And I did want to ask about the present day roster of artists who are performing at the Chatterbox, you know. And I think foremost on that list is Rob Dixon, who is a giant
yes.
in Indianapolis music. He's known as the mayor because of his prominent position here in the music scene. Tell me about what's happening today and Rob Dixon's role.
Yeah, Rob is the owner of Monday Nights, and essentially he took over Ferez's position when Ferez moved to Chicago. And that's really, really a great thing. I mean, because when Rob is at his gig or any gig, he often has three or four during a day's time, and he shows up and he just, boom, he's right there. And he works with all the musicians, and his bands are just tremendous. And both, number one, represent jazz very, very well, represent the community very, very well, and are incredible players. That's really the greatest. And his work with the Jazz Foundation and the Jazz Fest and so on. We additionally shine because he is there and he brings that reputation with him, and people want to see him and come to Chatterbox and every other place he plays.
Any other current players there you'd want to mention? I know the Tucker Brothers are a big part of the
Yeah, they're really
now.
Fabulous. Yeah. And one certainly up-and-coming, really incredible guitar player is also Charlie Ballantyne.
Yeah, of course.
And his wife, Amanda Gardier, phenomenal saxophone player. So it's the newer, younger crop. These are in their late 20s, early 30s, doing all incredible things. And then we have, the stalwart players, Brandon Meeks on bass for Rob Dixon's group regularly. He reminds me a lot of Max Hartstein, Brandon is there and he commands the stage when it's time for his solo. He has an incredible volume, gravitas, like Max did back then. So, I mean, those are great players. You know, Sean Imboden on saxophone, too. And then my weekend lineup that works. You know, still we have Monica Herzig is there. Frank Glover is there. Cassius Goins the third, great drummer. All of these guys. And then even this past weekend from Southern Indiana, Wade Baker on trumpet. All great group leaders. That are fantastic. We have really superb musicians on a regular basis, and I'm, like I said, I was totally unaware at the depth of the talent. Our last weekends of the month, Bill Myers, a Broad Ripple High School music theater graduate, holds down his group, which is fantastic. And then the next night, the last Saturday, Robert Coleman Jr., phenomenal blues jazz guitarist with Yvonne Liu on vocals. So that's like the first weekend and the last weekend, and that's the core of what we're all about, and it's great.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto.
My guest this week is David Andrechik, owner of The Chatterbox, a legendary jazz club in downtown Indianapolis. In addition to featuring prominent Indiana jazz musicians, The Chatterbox also hosted workshops from the famous Hoosier poet Etheridge Knight. Let's return to my conversation with David Andrechik as he shares his memories of Knight.
And one thing I definitely wanted to ask you about today is the bar's relationship with the great poet Etheridge Knight. You know, not only was he a regular customer at the Chatterbox, from what I understand, he also held his Free People's Poetry Workshop in the bar.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And he was great. Of course, those were the days when you could smoke inside bars, and he would just always have a cigarette and always a very long ash on the cigarette, and he'd find the ashtray and so on. But he was such a teacher, and people, when they began to know him, were maybe not worshiping, but he had lots of acolytes that would come in and listen. And when he would do this, you know, people would bring in their stuff and write it and do workshops and recitals and so on. And this was all before music, in the afternoon, early evening kind of thing. And one of the odd and expectable dilemmas that came is, of course, high school kids were learning about this too, and college kids, but they weren't 21. And of course, we were early days, it was like under the radar. And they didn't really want to drink. They wanted to be around Etheridge Knight and listen and learn and collaborate. Those were the good things. But before long, there were too many that were under 21. So we said, you know, come on, we can't do this anymore. And of course, that was a great deal of his great number of his audience that wanted to be with him and around him. So he chose to make some changes out, but still was a customer and so on, and lived just up the street in Barton Towers. Etheridge was there. He could just walk down, have his Budweiser, have his cigarettes, listen to jazz, and then talk poetry.
I started making up this poem when I was in solitary one time. After being called by a number for 5 years, 30,562, I was beginning to forget who I was. The idea of ancestry. Taped to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures, 47 black faces. My father, mother, grandmothers, one dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second, nieces and nephews. They stare across the space at me, sprawling on my bunk. I know their dark eyes, they know mine. I know their style, they know mine. I am all of them.
And David, I have to ask you about some of the famous visitors and guests that have both patronized the Chatterbox's customers and also sat in. I've heard that Wynton Marsalis came and sat in one night. Terrence Blanchard, who has an opera on the stage of the Metropolitan, came and sat in one night. Tell me about some of the famous people who sat in on stage.
Number one, we are really lucky to be on the radar. Part of that early radar was Chuck Workman, who was a radio guy, knew Dr. David Baker. I don't know if he went to IU with him or high school with him. I'm not sure which, but he did, I think it was WTPI. I'm not sure which radio station, but he had a jazz program regular and was the person about town to promote the jazz and help facilitate Wynton Marsalis coming to the Old National Center. It may have been the Murat at the time, I'm not sure, but across the street. And we were on their radar anyway because they had played up at Clues Hall a couple of times. And again, we had late night groups and they would come in and sit in. One of the best Wynton stories after the gig that was at the Old National Center, our music didn't start till 10:30. Their show started at 8, was over at 9:30, 10 o'clock kind of thing. And people were working their way over to Chatterbox. And the drummer, I forget who the drummer was unloading his vehicle. And they always have lots of gear, you know, to set up. And this guy's coming across the street from the Murat and says, can I help you with your gear? I'm going in, too. Sure. Picked it up, goes up, sets it on stage. And the drummer stands up and is like, you're Wynton Marsalis. He said, yeah, but we're all musicians. I'll help you. And so that was like that entree. It's like, yeah, we're on the same page. I'm known all over the world. Maybe you're just known here, but we're helping each other. We're part of that, which was just really fantastic. And that particular night, then Wynton's entire group, small core group, quintet, came over and sat in. We had people standing on the chairs against the wall so they could see, and then lined up way beyond our legal capacity, I'm sure, at that time, for them to hear Wynton Marsalis. Now, he regularly came and sat in, and if he had another gig that he had to leave after their local gig, many of his band members would come and sit in. As far as more or maybe most famous visitors,
right.
It was the 1989 Steel Wheels tour with the Rolling Stones. And they had two concerts, I believe, a Wednesday and a Thursday at the Hoosier Dome. I don't even know if it was the RCA Dome at the time or yet. And they were staying at the Canterbury, which was our only top-tier hotel downtown. I knew the concierge at the hotel, Mary Rose. She's in California now. And because she was a customer of the Jazz, you know, and I knew the limo driver, Scott Sanders. He's in California now, I think. But I get a phone call at the Chatterbox from Mary Rose. Who's playing tonight? Well, it's, I think it was Frank Glover. Mark Radway, probably Mad Harold Cardwell on drums, that kind of thing. He said, well, some of the Rolling Stones want to come over after their dinner, and I wanted to check if you have music. Yes, plays 9 to 12. How many customers you had? I said, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 or something like that. Can you ask every one of the customers to be cool about this if somebody comes in? And I said, sure, Mary Rose, we can do that. And that would be fine. And so we hung up, and she said likely they would come over within 30 minutes to, in order to hear the music. And so I talked to every one of the customers. I was training a bartender that evening. She'd been a customer. Her sister already worked there, but it was her first night. And when I talked to everybody, they said, oh, yeah, that's not going to happen. I don't believe you, and various other expletive deleted things. So I said, okay, but please, you know, behave. And it wasn't 15 minutes later, the two white limousines pull up in front of the front door, and everybody goes, oh, my God, he's telling the truth. And so it was Mick Jagger and Ron Wood, a couple of bodyguards, and a couple of ladies, women. I don't know if they were part of the group, but nonetheless, it was like six or seven people came in. And everybody behaved themselves, thankfully. And they kind of moved aside so this group of six or seven could sit in two tables together, which would have been table 3 and 4. And they were able to do that. And I said to my bartender, go and take their order. And they had some Heinekens and bottled water. We had bottled water at the time, the La Croix or La Croix from Wisconsin. We had lemon and lime and whatever. So they got some of that, one mixed drink. I don't remember how much it was, but they were there. The band was already playing. They were mid-set. And when they were at the end of their first set, they got up and talked to the band members. It was just a regular, like, musician to musician. They tried to get Charlie Watts on the phone. Now, I didn't know this at all during the time that Charlie had always had a jazz group outside of the Rolling Stones. I was unaware.
Yeah.
I am aware now. And they thought, my God, you got to hear this. You know, you're in town, and this is our night off before we play, and so on. They couldn't get him. Of course, cell phones didn't exist. They were using my dial wall phone to get to the hotel, and then they would ring the room and so on. They didn't get him. Meanwhile, my customers who were behaving themselves asked to use the wall phone because they were calling their friends.
Sure.
So, you know, you're standing up there, and it's got one of those long, curly cords, and you're you only had 7 digits right. at the time kind of thing. And the bodyguards kind of paid attention, and they knew what was going on. So before too long, they said, can we have our tab, please? And the tab was about $25 total. And the bodyguard gave my server a $50 bill, which you hardly saw it at all. And he said, keep the change. So she got to wait on Mick Jagger and Ron Wood, got a 100% tip her first night there, and was present for this iconic time, legendary time with the Rolling Stones, coming in to listen to music at the Chatterbox.
On her first night.
On her first night.
Yeah.
I've been holding out so long. I've been sleeping all alone. Lord, I'll miss you. I've been hanging on the phone.
David, you've built the Chatterbox into a very substantial part of the Indianapolis music scene. And, you know, the club has now a very important legacy that is, you know, carrying forward into the new generations of musicians, as you mentioned, Amanda Gardier and Charlie Valentine. How do you see the club's impact and legacy on the music scene of Indianapolis?
Well, certainly by both hook and crook and stubbornness and scrimping money, we have survived to allow it to happen. As I mentioned, we were initially going to do lots of renovations and had never been able to afford those kinds of things. But keeping it as an authentic music venue, it is a jazz dive. It's still a dive. Things, when they break, I fix them or get somebody to help fix them. But we haven't done major renovations. Part of that was always economic. We may get to a point in the next couple of years where that can happen, but it's not going to be a transformation. It's going to be nurturing the music. There's something about the size of that room. It's called a shotgun bar, just about 18 feet wide, about 11 and a half feet tall. In this case, it's 44 feet long. It's less than 1,000 square feet. I mean, less than 1,000 square feet in there, and we have this kind of legacy. The sound is good because of its size. It's human scale because you can feel, you can see this. You know, it's crowded, and that's much better in many, many ways. You're required, forced, let's say encouraged, to sit close to somebody you don't even know.
Yeah.
And what you're sharing is the musical experience. You might meet them that night. You might not know them, but then the next time you're in, you see them somewhere else. Weren't you here last week? You know, that kind of thing. But it's the human scale of the space, too, that has helped it. And the fact that the music is up front and you can walk through, you have to walk through, and people are looking towards you. Some people are slightly intimidated by that. But before long, it's like, oh, no, they're looking at the band. They're not looking at me. And then now I'm part of it. You become absorbed into the experience of that evening.
And David, I'm curious about the impact of this bar on your personal life, you know, 40th anniversary, if you could reflect on that.
Yeah.
When you were a student back at the University of Illinois, I'm sure you never imagined you'd spend 40 years of your life running a jazz bar.
Correct.
So how has this impacted your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly my family. My parents moved down here 15 years ago, and they both passed. So I no longer have the closeness of family that was here. But they moved here to be close to I was the closest geographic kid, family elsewhere. But they had regularly come down to visit and part of the Chatterbox. So they would come on our special events and really enjoy that. But they also knew that that was my extended family, the musicians, the customers, my bartender servers for many, many years. That is my family with that legacy. And I cherish it. I really, really do.
Yeah. And finally, I know you've contemplated your future with this establishment. What would you like to see happen to the Chatterbox?
Certainly the preservation of that legacy of music and nurturing younger talent And that's part of a couple of conversations I've had with people, including Rob Dixon, who might lead that in a way, maybe creating a not-for-profit status for the cultural element to it, and then having covenants on the space for rent in perpetuity, that kind of thing, in order to make it all work. But to, in some way, still have a personal interest in it. Maybe I'm essentially bought out over a decade and still have the ability to be part of it and do sing-alongs and do the Chatterbox Bowling League, which we didn't talk about, stuff like that. The things that make it more family-like and are extensions of what goes on, because people meet because of the music, but then they become interested in the actual people that are there as customers and friends and acquaintances, and then they join other things, you know, and they're a part of our expanded activities and become part of my extended family.
Well, David, I can't thank you enough for taking time to go through all this incredible history with me. You know, I'm a longtime patron of the Chatterbox and
thank you for that.
So many wonderful memories of my experiences there. So thank you so much for your contribution to the local music culture, and thank you for being here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Kyle.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you to my guest, David Andrzejczyk, and thank you for tuning in. Let's end with music from the Hampton Sisters, one of many important Indianapolis jazz groups to be featured at the Chatterbox. From the 2003 album, The Hampton Sisters, a jazz tribute, this is What a Wonderful World. I'm Kyle Long, and you've been listening to Cultural Manifesto.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom. I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, also on the faces, people going by. I see friends shaking hands,